Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Choir Fam podcast.
I'm Dean Leithy, the Director of Choral Activities at Washington State University.
And I'm Matthew Myers, the Associate Director of Choral Activities at Washington State University.
Back in 2021, we yearned for more connection with choral colleagues we had not seen in months or years and sought out ways to bring our choral community together. We started this podcast to spark more conversations about the current state of choral music and what it will look like in the future.
So here we are. We bring guests from the worldwide choir fam onto the show to share their wisdom and help make our choral world a little bit closer. We hope that by listening to each guest's story, you can find interesting tidbits of knowledge and fresh ideas that you can use in your day-to-day rehearsals.
We also hope that our conversations about the current issues in our field will help us all to move the choral art form forward and make its role more prominent in our society.
We hope you'll enjoy these conversations as we work to strengthen our choral community. Welcome to the Choir Fam.
Well, good afternoon, Matt. How are you doing? Has it been a good week?
Yeah, it has. It's been a busy one, but yeah, things are going really well. We are 1 month out from our Festival of Contemporary Artists and Music. And yeah, we're getting there on these world premieres that we're about to do. Dean, tell us a little bit about this event. What is FOCAM?
Sure. So the WSU Festival of Contemporary Artists and Music is a time where we bring in a guest composer. They do some lectures for us. They do a little comp lessons for some of our composition students. And we have a celebration of both faculty and student compositions, as well as we do a call for international compositions. And so this year, our guest composer is Dale Trumbore, which is really exciting for us here. So we're going to be performing a number of her works, as well as doing a premiere with all the WSU choirs, as well as the Palouse Choral Society. We're just very excited about that. And that side by side with a number of student compositions and a number of other premieres. So it's really exciting. With something that is really exciting that way, there's anxiety there. And that's part of the trick too, right? But all very exciting. So it's really neat. Yeah.
So 1 month out, that's a great place to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
We basically know the notes. Now it's time to turn it into art. So we'll get that. So Dean, you were kind enough to invite our guest today. Can you tell our audience a little bit about our guest and why you've brought him here?
Absolutely. So Stephen Caldwell, know by repute. He has been recommended to us for the podcast. I know of Stephen just from hearing his choir, the Schola Cantorum, seeing some of his arrangements, some of his compositions. And like many of our other guests that we have on here, think he would be someone wonderful to talk to and think our listeners are going to have a good time.
Yeah. So here's a little bit more about Stephen. Dr. Stephen Caldwell is associate professor and outgoing chair of the Faculty Senate at the University of Arkansas. He is a nationally recognized conducting pedagogue and scholar in demand as clinician, conductor, and composer. At Arkansas, he conducts the nationally renowned Schola Cantorum, teaches the undergraduate sequence and conducting technique, graduate conducting lessons, and the graduate sequence in choral history and literature. Since his arrival in 2012, he has twice been awarded the Associated Student Government's Top 10 Most Outstanding Faculty Award. He has received the Golden Tusk from the Division of Student Affairs. He is a four-time Outstanding Mentor, the inaugural recipient of the Paul Cronin Award for Excellence in Teaching with Technology, and was named one of the top 10 artistic people to watch in Northwest Arkansas. Under his direction and leadership, the Schola Cantorum has become one of the leading collegiate choirs in America, appearing at numerous conferences of NCCO, Southwest ACDA, and Arkansas ACDA, while touring internationally to the Republic of Serbia, Belgium, Germany, and Puerto Rico, and collecting more than 500,000 views on YouTube. He has conducted more than 40 works with orchestra and has prepared choirs for performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Delaware Symphony, Arkansas Philharmonic, and the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas. He has presented interest sessions at multiple regional and national conferences of the American Choral Directors Association and the National Collegiate Choral Organization, and was an ACDA International Conducting Exchange Fellow in Kenya. He has conducted district, region, and all-state choirs across the country, and his original multi-award-winning compositions and arrangements are performed throughout the world. Dr. Caldwell holds a Bachelor of Music Education from the University of Northern Colorado, two Master of Music degrees from Temple University, and a Doctor of Musical Arts degree from Rutgers University.
So, Stephen, thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Choir Fam.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, where are you in your semester? Did you start early January with your semester? Are you on quarters? Where are you right now?
Well, we're on semesters. We started day after MLK, so we just completed our third week of class, minus a few snow days that were thrown in there, which is always a wrench. Actually, the very first day of this semester was a snow day.
Oh. So did you get a bunch of snow, or it was a bit of snow that's not you're not used to? How does that work over in Arkansas?
Yeah, here in Arkansas, it's much ado about nothing, and we missed 2 days of school. The first 2 days of the semester were canceled for less than an inch of snow.
Yeah. Dean and I are both from parts of the country where that's just not really a thing.
Me too. You know,
South Dakota, we would get a snow day after like 3 feet. Mm-hmm. But then when I went to LSU for my doctorate, we would call like 2 days off before anything fell, and it still never fell. Yeah, some of my
usually
best
I wouldn't be so I wouldn't be so disappointed with a snow day, but in this case, it was the very first day and the very second day of the semester were both called for snow, and so that only gave us 2 days to do all of the registration nonsense that inherently comes with a new semester. Placements, it got very frantic there in those 2 days because we had to do a week's worth of work in just the Thursday and Friday.
Yeah, those first days are just structural and they set a tone, all of that stuff. Yeah. Well, on the one side, you know, there's that, well, that's not that much snow, blah, blah, blah. And there's the other side. Gosh, it'd be nice to have it warmer down there. That'd be awesome. I mean,
right?
I'd love to live in a warmer climate. That'd be great.
It's 70 degrees today.
Oh my gosh.
Just 2 weeks later. How the times have changed.
Yeah.
Well, we're at 45, which is balmy. So, and Punxsutawney Phil today told us that winter is over. So
spring is coming.
Yeah. So, Stephen, we ask all of our guests the same open-ended question to kind of get things going. So take this wherever it works for you. But how did you fall in love with choral music?
Oh, that's easy. So my origin story is that I had played saxophone since fifth grade. You know, just I was a result of public music education. And so in fourth grade rolled around, they put a recorder in our hands and we all played recorder. Fifth grade comes around and, I got a saxophone and my parents really, they don't really remember exactly how it was the saxophone that I ended up with, but that's the one I ended up with. And I played saxophone fifth grade all the way through high school on top of the rest of public music education classes. I was an athlete, so I was playing, I was playing soccer and playing baseball, and music really just wasn't on my radar until my junior year of high school when I auditioned for the musical, which was Guys and Dolls that year, as a dare from some of the guys on the soccer team. And, I went in and decided to audition for the musical. And, crazy thing happened. They handed me the piece of music and it was Luck Be a Lady. And they said, did you prepare it? And I said, no, but I'll just read the music. And they looked at me and they did the puppy head tilt. And they said, you know how to read music? And I thought, well, yeah, I know how to read music. I've been in music classes for 11 years now. Like, you have been teaching me music. I thought that everybody paid attention. And so the piano started and I started singing Luck Be a Lady. And the who I now know was the choir director. He did one of those classic looking up slowly from the clipboard moments with me. As he saw that A, I could match pitch, B, had a decent enough voice for, just 6 months out of a voice change type of young man. But most importantly, I could read music. And so just after that, he put me in he asked if I would sing in the chamber choir there and that school. And I said, sure. I had the time open. So I started singing in the chamber choir. And, you know, it was from that moment. I had played in bands in all those years, but I never had the kind of hair on the back of my neck moment where it stands up like I did in the first, I don't know, 15 minutes or 20 minutes of singing with the choir there. And from then I was hooked and I never stopped.
Yeah. So you got your bachelor's in music education. Did you know like it was going to be choir or just music and either saxophone or choir? Or how did you make that choice?
I thought I was going to be a career high school teacher. And that's what I had set out to do when I went to college. Now I went to school in Colorado because music wasn't my primary focus. What I wanted to do was be a ski bum. And so I felt that, going to college in Colorado was a good way to do both. So I packed up everything and moved up to Colorado where I could both study music and ski 40 days a year. And I did both and enjoyed both, and have no regrets. And then of course, you know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, but now things that you never consider when you're 18 and nobody tells you otherwise. So at the end of that, now I have a Colorado licensure and I realized how difficult it would be to convert the Colorado licensure to a Pennsylvania licensure. So I stayed in Colorado to teach. And so I was a high school teacher for 5 years after that. And I really thought that that was going to be the model and that was going to be my path. But as it turns out, I started singing more and more. I auditioned for the Opera Colorado chorus, just on a Larth. I saw an advertisement in the Rocky Mountain News, which doesn't exist anymore. And so I went to the open call audition and had another experience where the chorus master, who's John Burrill, who's longly associated with Central City Opera in Colorado. You know, I walked in and, you know, I was completely out of nowhere. Nobody knew I was coming. And I sang Quanto è Bella, which was one of the songs I did at my senior recital. And then they had me do some sight reading. And I just, you know, I sight read it perfectly. And he was like, where have you been all my life? How, here's a chorus contract. And the Opera Colorado chorus contract wasn't a lot, but it was paid. And, you know, it was another experience. And then I started to get the singing bug and I was singing more and more as a gig singer. And so after a number of years teaching, that's when I decided to go back and get a master's in vocal performance to make a go at being a gig singer. And then I did that for a while, which was great. And I met my wife, who was also a gig singer. And, you know, we sang a lot in the Philadelphia market and the New York market and did all kinds of stuff, bad choirs, good choirs, chamber music, big symphonic stuff, recitals, bad opera, good opera, the whole lot, until... Alan Harler, who has since retired, Alan Harler was at Temple. Upon my graduation with my master's in vocal performance, he sat me down and he said, Stephen, sit down. And I said, you know, what's up, professor? And he said, we both know you're not going to be a singer. You're going to be a conductor. So I want you to stay for 2 more years and do a master's in conducting. And this was as like the day I was graduating. I had no conceived notion of staying for another 2 years and doing a master's in conducting at that point. But it took a professor who recognized that I had a certain skill set and that perhaps I wasn't pursuing the career path for which I was most adapted. And so he sat me down and he said, I think you're going to have a career as a conductor and not as a singer, and I'm going to help you get there. And so I listened to him, and the rest is history now, 20 years later.
So, when you were teaching, tell us a little bit about your time teaching. What kind of choirs did you have? Like, where was it? And maybe some of the interesting lessons you learned during that time.
Yeah, I started at Chatfield High School, which is in Jefferson County School District, just on the west side of Denver. And the very first class was all freshman girls at 7:29 in the morning. And so, you know, I cut my teeth on a difficult room, so to speak. And, you know, I came to really love that choir, but I was ill-prepared for a group of you know, 90, 14-year-old girls all by myself at 21 years old. And I very quickly found the skills to command that room and to manage that room. And then I had multiple choirs there. You know, your standard, there was a treble chorus, but there wasn't enough tenors and basses for a tenor bass chorus. And we had an unauditioned mixed chorus and a mixed chorus and an auditioned mixed chorus, you know, your chamber choir. And it was, you know, it was a brilliant experience. And, you know, I wouldn't have changed any decisions that I made in the past for anything in the world. But it's incredible how much of my teaching is still informed by my freshman girls choir at 7:29 in the morning, because that's when I realized who I needed to be in front of a group to command a room on a moment to moment basis. And, you know, I think 14 years old is just that age. You know, they're not quite adults, but they're not quite kids. You know, that's the age, any gender, you know, not just a treble chorus, but a tenor bass chorus as well. You know, at that 14 years old, eighth grade, ninth grade, even if it's a brilliant group, you know, that's the age where you never know what you're going to get. I mean, some days that group is going to love you and be your best friend and be the greatest choir and class you've ever conducted. And then the next day, you know, the hormones shift and it's an absolute nightmare. You know, they're 14 years old is like the unstable year for kids in their development. And that's what I love about it so much looking back is the uncertainty of what that room was going to be like on a daily basis. And therefore, how do I adapt to be in front of that group and command that room as a teacher, as a musician, as a conductor, et cetera. And now, again, that informs everything that I do and have done since.
If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
So you were spending time after that gigging around, doing different things. You said operas and choruses, perhaps a church job here or there. Maybe that's how it went. Tell us some of the lessons you learned about the choirs that you worked with, the opera programs that you sang with, and how you might bring some of those, maybe as a gigging musician, the entrepreneurial side. I think I'm saying that right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How you bring in that side of a gigging musician to perhaps either the education of what you give your students today or, you know, how you brought that to your master's.
The greatest lesson that I learned as a gig singer in all the years that I did it is that your career and your reputation are built one chance at a time, and you get one chance and one chance only. And so I beat my chest in front of my students here every day about you cannot afford to be late. If you are on the clock and you are 1 minute late, you will be unemployed and that's it. Like, you get one chance to prove that you can show up on time, and you get one chance to prove that you're going to be prepared and you're going to be that singer who's not going to miss a note. And that was a reputation that took me years to build. I was lucky. I was studying it, you know, as a master's student at Temple, and at any university, you know, we get a lot of phone calls. People need a musician for this or that. And something came in, somebody needed a tenor to sub at a church in Philadelphia. And I was next on the ask list and I showed up on time. I've always been a really good sight reader. And so I sight read everything perfectly. I didn't make a mistake. I shook the guy's hand on the way out and, you know, we didn't talk or anything, and we didn't have any major interaction other than I showed up on time, prepared, I did the job well, and then I left. And 2 days later, that was a Sunday. And then 2 days later on Tuesday, when I saw that professor again, that professor came to me and said, "I just want you to know that I heard about how well you did on that sub gig. So thanks for that." And that's when I realized, oh, right, this is all connected. So here I am in my youth thinking that I'm a hotshot, not realizing that everything is an audition and that it was going to come back to the person who recommended me for that gig, how well I did for that gig, and that I'm not only representing myself, but I'm also representing the reputation of the person who recommended me for that gig too. And if I want people to go out on a limb for me and recommend me for a gig, then I have to make sure that I'm protecting their reputation as well as my own. And then the wider that web gets, the more careful you have to be with it. And so step by step, we build that. And that starts with never being late, always being prepared, and almost never missing a note. Now, nobody bats 1,000 in music. You're going to hit a clam every now and then. You don't have many clams that you can hit before the gigs are going to dry up.
So kind of a follow-up, I think these are such important life lessons to impart to our students. And I personally felt that was a little easier before the pandemic hit. And now I just feel like there is a lot more absenteeism. We definitely, like, if there's a tickle, you shouldn't show up to any classes for 2 weeks was kind of the vibe for a while. Now, I encourage students, wear a mask if they're not feeling 100%, but try to be present if at all possible. How have you adapted in, if any way, these mantras? And yeah, do you feel like it's any more difficult to communicate this to the students of 2024?
The students are having a more difficult time. I would agree with your assessment of absenteeism. 2022 was a really dismal year. 2023 got better. And this is the first year. This is what, 23, 24. And this is the first year I really felt like we were back entirely, where the absenteeism and the lateness really started to go away. But there was some lingering effects of that. And I'm outside of the New York Philly gig scene entirely, personally, but I still have all my contacts and friends who live there. And I can assure you, and I was assuring all of my students, that all of those gigs, as they started to come back online, they were not as they were not as giving as perhaps a professor would be about, missing a class. The rules went right back to what the rules are. Only now there was an extra 2 years worth of people in the cache who were all desperate to get work again. So, you get a couple of chances, before the pandemic, and after the pandemic, you don't get any chances because the line is so long for the people who want to gig again. Like, you just can't be late and you still have to be prepared. But the lateness, man, that is the big one. If you're going to be a professional singer, you just can't be late ever. And that's even more true now in the gig scene than it has ever been, despite the fact that singers are struggling with it more. And said those singers are ultimately going to reap the consequences of their own time mismanagement.
So you were at Temple, you were working on then your second master's, your conducting degree. What happened after that? I see that you went to Rutgers. Was that immediately after? Did you go do something in between? How did that work out, and why Rutgers? How did that work out?
So Rutgers is the only doctoral program within a reasonable commutable distance to the Philadelphia metro area and the New York metro area for that matter, right? It is a one of a kind where it is. It's the only doctoral program in New Jersey, but there aren't any doctoral programs in the Philadelphia metro region either. And the next one that you would get to would be Yale all the way up in Connecticut, and then NEC. Up in Boston, and then the next one south is Maryland. So you University of Maryland, University Park. So Rutgers is an island unto itself. And by that time I had met a girl, and she had a budding career of her own. And I was at a point where if I wanted to do doctoral studies, I couldn't uproot her. I couldn't ask her to do that, to just suspend everything in her life so that we could move to Michigan or California or Washington. For the sole purpose of my own personal betterment. I applied to Rutgers, and Alan Harler picked up the phone and called Pat Gardner, both of whom are now retired. And Alan said, "Pat, this guy's great and you got to take him." And Alan really went to bat for me and really helped me get into the one program that was going to work if I was going to do a doctorate, because at the time I loved my new wife more than I loved the possibility of a career in higher education. And if I was asked to choose between the two, I would have chosen her and still would. I was at a point where I was fortunate in my ability to study at Rutgers, which is of course a top-notch program, and was able to get me the training that I needed, but also at the time I didn't have to disturb the life of my new marriage.
So tell us about your experience at Rutgers. What are some things that you say, well, I'm teaching like this today, or I'm hearing like this today, or I'm speaking to people like this today, for the tutelage that I got at Rutgers or this person? What can you give us in regards to your education there?
My experience at Rutgers was a brilliant experience. Now, you know, each program is a little bit different when you're talking about where you want to study and with whom you want to study. That's important. You know, Pat Gardner, who's recently retired, he's a brilliant teacher, and he's a rep guy, and I really appreciate that. You know, he's a professor who is really committed to the classical choral canon, and wants his doctoral students to understand the nature of it from chant all the way through modern day. And it's a real life lived experience. And it was, you know, it was meetings in the library 2 and 3 times a week for 3 years of just getting out the scores and looking at the scores and talking through the scores. And the repetition through the repertory in that program, I think is really unique. You know, it's essentially 6 full semesters of 4-credit choral literature courses. Now, you don't get all that credit, but that's just what you did with Pat Gardner was, you know, every week, 2 and 3 times you go to the library and he would get a bunch of scores, you know, take some random score out and off the shelf and he puts it in front of you and says, tell me what it is. And, you know, at the beginning, that's really difficult until you realize you get into that process and you start to see scores in a different way. The genres and the time periods and the individual elements of the composers, they start to pop up and you build these lists of repertory in your head. And that fit me and the type of student I am. You know, Rutgers is a small program, usually only one or two doctoral students at a time, as opposed to a big cohort. And the kind of model for when I was there, which was kind of, there's the library. There's a lot of books in there and you got to read them all and your comps are in 3 years. Good luck. But for me as a individually driven student, I didn't need more encouragement than that. Just tell me what I have to do and give me the timeline when it has to get done. And I'll get it done for you. And not every student works well in that environment. You know, some students need a cohort, you need study groups. Some students, for whatever reason, they need a little bit more oversight from a professor, from a PhD advisor, in this case, a DMA advisor, you know, constant updates and checking in and the like. And, you know, that wasn't the type of student that I was. And so I was able to really thrive in that environment where the expectation was set what I needed to do at the end of the 3 years. And then I was kind of allowed to explore that path in my own speed, in my own time. And that included, you know, a semester release where I was I filled in for Stephen Sammets at Lehigh University when he went on sabbatical, and then ended up teaching part-time at Lehigh University for another full year after that while I was a doctoral student at Rutgers. I was conducting a choir, the Rainbow Chorale of Delaware in Wilmington, Delaware, which is 90 miles south of Rutgers. That was on Monday nights. And, you know, and I had the freedom to, while I was a doctoral student, to be actively teaching at Lehigh University, to be actively gigging in New York, in Delaware, in Philadelphia, and having that reign to design my own studies. And it was a brilliant and singular experience.
So you finished with Rutgers, or perhaps your ABD, not necessarily knowing.
No, I finished three years up and out.
3 years and done. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
After that, more gigging? Did you head someplace else? What happened next?
Well, that as the graduation year comes, you know, that's when you throw all of the applications at the wall and see what sticks. And you know, I was fortunate in my up and out year after my doctorate to have a couple of options, and the opportunity opened up at the University of Arkansas at the time that I was graduating, and it was a good fit. And so I moved down here and began my journey. And, you know, interestingly enough, my wife didn't come the first year. We didn't have kids yet. And she was not unwilling to move to Arkansas, but she really wanted to make sure that this was the right job. And so she kept her job in Philadelphia, and we did a little commuter marriage there for the 9 months of my first year of teaching. And then once I was convinced that this was going to be, a good long-term fit, then she decided to move down and meet me here. And then we've been in Arkansas ever since. And now we're raising our son here.
So tell us a bit about when your composition bug came, when did you start writing music? Was it out of necessity, or you're saying, well, I got this choir I want to write something for? When did that start?
That started as a high school teacher right away. And I tell my students this all the time. You don't think you're a composer until you get a choir that has, you know, 92 sopranos, 71 altos, 4 basses, and 9 tenors. And you have to get rep for them. And you realize that the rep doesn't exist that's going to make that choir sound good. And you have the expertise to write the music that's going to make that choir sound good. And you're not going to write it a whole cloth at first by yourself. But what you're going to do is you're going to take a great piece, you know, any piece of in Renaissance polyphony, for example, and you're going to modify it in real time to fit the ensemble that you have. Because your ninth grade boys, for example, you know, their voices are going to be all over the place. And the tenor bass split that you have at the beginning of the year is not going to be the same as the tenor bass split at the end of the year. You're going to have ranges that are moving around, and it's going to be your job to move those ranges around on the score, to displace octaves, to revoice, because you've got a really great bass section, but they can only sing in tune within a fifth. And so you're going to revoice all the chords so that your basses stay in that fifth. And so you kind of start to reblock other people's music from the canon to make it fit for your educational choir. And what you'll realize is that you get better and better and better at it over time until you start writing those pieces from scratch originally by yourself. And so that process was just in those early days of teaching, of arranging in real time the repertory that I really wanted to do for the choir that was there, because of the nature of 8th and 9th and 10th grade and 11th grade choirs and how they change so quickly and so often. And, you know, by then I liked doing it. And so I just decided to kind of keep doing it. And, you know, it's nice to have a lab choir like the Schola Cantorum here at the University of Arkansas, where I can essentially write anything I want for them and they can do it. And that means that in real time, you know, I can go through the creative process with them and get real time feedback from them. And so we can have a more collaborative process as opposed to just writing a piece, having them sing it as if it's written in marble. They watch me make adjustments in real time. They watch me change my mind for things that I thought would work, but absolutely didn't work. And then my favorite part is when you have a choir that's really your own. And, you know, I've conducted the Schola Cantorum since 2012 now. And so, you know, that is my choir. That's my sound. It's my expectation. Anything that they do is 100% my fault, good or bad. But that also means, you know, with every singer in that group, hand selected by me to be in that group, I have a very intimate knowledge individually on each one of their voices, what they can and can't do, what the ranges are. So on any given year, I can write a piece for them that is perfectly crafted to exactly the way that they sound in that given year or semester. And that is really fun because you get to maximally exploit the beauty of the ensemble that you have at that time. And it's a beauty that only a longtime director could know is in that ensemble at any one time. And it's just a brilliant relationship when you can get that back and forth with an ensemble.
So in your artistic process of creating these compositions or arrangements, of course, it's the Stephen Caldwell voice. But we're products of our environment and those things that we've heard. So if you had to say, maybe my music is a bit like, or this influenced me, How would you communicate that to somebody?
By far my biggest influence of any musician in any genre is Keith Jarrett. For those of you who don't know, Keith Jarrett is a pianist. He's still alive, but he's quite old now and has suffered a series of strokes, so he can't play anymore. Keith Jarrett at the keyboard through the 70s and 80s, specifically 60s too, through that era of the 20th century, I say without exaggeration that he was the greatest pianist on the planet. And that is taking into account, you know, Bill Evans and Oscar Peterson, and then, you know, Andre Watt and the big classical pianist too. What Keith Jarrett could do at the piano was, from my perspective, singular and akin to what Mozart or Bach would be like in modern day, how he approached harmony and counterpoint, I think is just absolutely second to none. And so listening to Keith Jarrett over and over and over it all years, and largely what he did was improvise. You know, that having that in my ear and listening to the way that he uses harmony, which is so different from the way that other people use harmony, gave me a freedom very early on when I started putting pen to paper and writing music, because I didn't feel like I was beholden to the rules of counterpoint that I was taught in college. Because Keith Jarrett never stuck to those rules anyway, and listen to his music. It's absolutely incredible. And it's all tonal. I mean, it's analyzable. You can write it down, you can transcribe it. But to try and compose like that, you know, for me would be impossible. I have, you know, a millimeter of talent compared to a musician like Keith Jarrett. But if you listen to Keith Jarrett, you can hear pretty much how I write, how I modulate, how I treat chromaticisms and harmony and dissonance. And it's all there. And I suppose, you know, the Whitaker sound is in pretty much everybody this year in this era. And the Lauridsen sound, you know, the first inversion with the added ninth and the dissonance, you know, that's certainly a little bit in there. It sounds nice for choirs. It's kind of ubiquitous in that sound. A little bit of Ole Yellow in there as well with his jam is the way that he sets up grooves and then will write increasingly complex music over what started as a very simple groove. That's all that's in there as well. But Keith Jarrett is where it starts at for my influence.
So 12 years in at University of Arkansas, can you tell us what it's like at this point in the career versus first year there? What are the things that you are really proud of that you've been able to grow, and, you know, what were the best and toughest things as you were starting out?
Yeah, at the beginning, the hardest part is the match. You know, is the conductor and the ensemble the right match? And of course, you know, the first year it's not my ensemble. The 80% of the choir who is left over from previous years were, you know, that was somebody else's choir and they had somebody else's expectation. And, you know, the second year they're half yours, and the third year they're mostly yours. And so, you know, it takes a full class, whether you're at a high school or whether you're at a college, it takes a full class of 4 years before everybody in that ensemble is your student, is living up to your expectation and has bought in to what it is, whatever it is that you're throwing down. And so, you know, that takes me out to 2016. And it was really when we performed spring 2015 at the Arkansas All-State Conference. That was kind of my coming out party, if you will, here in Arkansas. Because, you know, I had done my best to get to a number of schools. But here in Arkansas, Arkansas collegiate teachers, we were not permitted to conduct the Arkansas All-State Choir. So that's not something that was permissible in any case. So of course, I was never really up in front of those students. So performing at the All-State Conference for all of the All-State choirs was the first time that really the state was able to hear what it is that I was doing. And that was really after the 4 years that I had been here. So that was the first time that it was really all my singers, all my choir. You know, the rep that I wanted to do and the style that I wanted to do it. And it took 4 years to get there. And that was a really brilliant experience. You know, then after that, you can do a little less. It's a little less hard because after you're a little bit more of a known quantity, you don't have to work as hard to convince people to audition for you. And after that moment, you know, I had the trust of the teachers in the state. And so when they would get wind that a student wanted to, you know, to audition or they were going to attend the University of Arkansas, right? They would get the whisper in the ear, be sure to audition for the Schola Cantorum. I hear Dr. Caldwell's great. You know, that was 4 and 5 years in the making of hard work and convincing and conducting in the trenches, so to speak. Then I thought I really had a great thing going. You know, we did a number of conference performances and whatnot leading up to the pandemic. And of course, the pandemic just slaughtered all of our programs. And no doubt it was the same at WSU as it was here at Arkansas and at so many other places. And it's incredible to me how many of my students stayed and hacked it through, you know, the 2 years of virtual choir and masks and distancing. And I just past December, last 2 months ago now, I graduated my last two students who were with me during the pandemic. And it was, you know, of course, I was proud to see them go, but it was really bittersweet because that was the last of those students who stuck it out. And now all of the students who are in the group, these are all post-pandemic students. And it took the 22-23 region to get that going again, because much like 2012, right, I was showing it with these students, they were coming out of the pandemic, coming out of the virtual environment, and it was harder for them to buy in because the last 2 years of their own choral singing had been on Zoom and it had been on virtual choirs on YouTube and the like. And so we're back again. And so, you know, we are back 23, 24 now. I feel like we're back to where we were in 17, 18, 19, where the ship is really humming. And what I like about it artistically is I feel like my group can do anything that I can think up. And that is artistically freeing. You know, I can paint with any color. I can paint with any size brush. I can use any size canvas. I can paint any picture that I would like. And I have a choir after all these years who will let me do it. You know, and if, you know, if they don't like a piece, they let me know. Right. And that's fine. But, you know, they've bought into that process, and to have that choir that can just do anything that I can think up, I think is really freeing, because I can be totally free in my artistic planning. You know, I can write for them. I can program really, really hard repertory for them. And they know, because now there's a history of them performing some exceptionally difficult stuff. They know what it's going to be like at the beginning and it's going to be a slog. And they trust me in that process to get them to a point where they can perform some of that really difficult music in the end. And it's just, it's a great relationship that we have now back and forth with the choir.
And things must have been going pretty well if you decided to go ahead and record an album with these singers. So we know that in 2023, a new album came out with your Schola Antorum, Schola Cantorum, Wander Thirst, the choral music of Florence Price. Can you tell us a little bit about this project, you know, how you decided to get going and what it was like delving into the music of this composer?
I would love to tell you about Florence Price and about our album. And this was, it was all serendipitous. The year after I arrived here at Arkansas, Arkansas Special Collections obtained all of the archive of the materials of Florence Beatrice Price that were found in an abandoned house in 2008. And so I had the treasure trove of research materials dropped in my literal lap. The archive is about 100 feet away from where my studio is on campus. And, you know, I was working with the archive when it first opened to, you know, go through. I was the first one to see what choral materials were there and what would work. And to have an American composer of such note, to have her music just dropped in my lap that nobody else had ever heard before was perhaps, you know, it was just an academic serendipity like no other. And so, you know, I immediately got to work going through the archives, and little by little, piece by piece, I would take one piece out and I would transcribe it, re-engrave it, any editing that needed to happen, you know, no corrections and whatnot, and we would perform it. So we did a couple of our pieces in that first year in 2014, and then we did another couple in 2016. And then in 2020, when we performed at the Southwest ACDA conference, we did three of her pieces. But in those years, I had already worked through eight pieces of the archive, and we, you know, threw some videos up on YouTube, and it proved to be very, very popular. Then her catalog was acquired by Wise Music Classical, and they took over the publishing duties of her work, which was good because that got it out to more people. And so when I was coming out of the pandemic, like how am I going to restart this thing? The idea that I wanted to do for a while was an album of Florence Price's choral music. And so during the pandemic, I was able to write some grants and get some funding. The total album cost was about $30,000, which is no small change. And then fall of whatever, that was fall 22, when you know, we were just about back from the pandemic. We were back in person, no masks anymore, no distancing anymore. And all of the students were back and comfortable with that model. We started rehearsing that music and we gave a concert of all of her music and then took it into the studio. And by studio, I mean a nice resonant church. We recorded at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church here in Fayetteville. We needed a church because the communion service in F, which is on the album, and Praise the Lord, which is on the album, both require organ. And so we needed an organ that was really nice and in tune and in a nice space where we could record that organ. And so we went in there and laid down the tracks, and 6 months of editing and sore wrists from carpal tunnel, we were able to release that album in April 2023. And it's, you know, very exciting project for me academically, because it's the result of essentially a decade's worth of work on her manuscripts. And it's just the first part. You know, there's I bet there's about three full albums worth of choral music in there. And, you know, volume two and volume three are already kicking around my head. Volume two is going to include all of her spiritual settings, amongst a couple of other of our secular songs. And then the third album is going to be your big stuff, like Abraham Lincoln Walks at Midnight, which you need very large choir, very large orchestra, you know, a little bit more resources to record that. And so to get to this first part where we can get her music out there, has been great. You know, as kind of the de facto point man on her music, just because I'm known with her choral scores now, at least once a week, sometimes two and three times a week, I'll get an email from somebody looking for her score, and I can point them to where they can get the score. I can point them to recordings, and we have documented evidence now that her recordings are her manuscripts now are being performed more and more and more. And you know, that is the greatest compliment, is that there is a hunger for her music. There's a desire to listen to it. Our streaming statistics are all over the world, in Europe and America specifically, but not exclusively. Asia, Africa, Australia, we're getting streams from all over the world. People are coming to a realization of who this composer was. And I feel like for the first time, her music is really taking her place amongst the canon with a capital C, you know, where she's not a niche composer, of just spiritual settings, or known for just the Marian Anderson concert in 1939, where Marian Anderson performed one of her song settings. You know, there's broader access to her recordings now, broader access to a large swath of her manuscripts, choral music, piano music, orchestral music, etc. And there's a hunger for it now. And to watch that has been very exciting and very rewarding.
So for those of you who have not heard this album yet, here is the song Weathers by the University of Arkansas Schola Cantorum on their album Wander Thirst, the choral music of Florence Price. So, Matt, do you think now is a time to move on to the lightning round?
Yeah, let's do it. So, Stephen, we've got this series of questions for you, just for our audience to get to know you a little bit more as a person, not necessarily as the choir director. So whatever comes to mind is a great answer. Here's your first question. Are you a night or morning person?
Morning.
What is your least favorite chore?
Least favorite chore? Oh, wow. Mowing the grass when it's more than 100 degrees.
If you could be an Olympic athlete in any sport, which sport would you want to compete in?
Soccer.
What book or TV show would you turn into a Broadway musical?
I would love to see The Lord of the Rings as the musical.
And in that musical, what role would you want to play?
Frodo, of course.
What is your favorite teaching trick or hack?
Teaching trick or hack? Teaching pitch. So I begin every single one of my rehearsals with the choir humming an A without any assistance from the piano. And it's always a disaster on the first day, and it's usually a little bit better on the second day. And here we are in January, and my students can pull pitches out of the air. And starting with the A, like an oboe tunes an orchestra, I think is crucial for choral development instead of playing a chord first for them, which only teaches them to listen, not to generate the pitch in and of themselves.
If you had to pick one favorite choral piece, what would it be?
Ooh, my favorite choral piece, the one that really got me into music, was Morten Lauritsen's O Magnum Mysterium. So I suppose I should pour one out on the curb for that, because that's why I'm here. That has been replaced in recent years. My favorite piece right now is La Guerre by Clément Jeannequin, which I find eminently fascinating and endlessly interesting. And it's now the third time that I've conducted it. This is the first time I'm conducting with collegiate singers. And every time I open that score, I find more gems. And I'm just totally impressed by his genius.
What is one composer you feel needs more attention?
Lawrence Price.
That's a pretty easy answer, I think.
Everybody. There is a score out there for every level of ensemble. She's got SAB stuff, SSA, TTB, SATB, unaccompanied, accompanied, with organ, without organ, liturgical, sacred, secular, all of it. If you have a choir, there is a perfect piece by Florence Price for you.
Awesome. What is your favorite memory associated with choral music?
Probably conducting my own work, Pre-Existing Condition, which is about my son's congenital heart disease, on the stage of Carnegie Hall with my son in the audience.
What projects are you working on right now that you're excited about?
Well, the big one is I'm digging into Price's Communion Service in F and re-engraving it. So for our recording, the piece on a whole. It's not that it's unfinished; it's that the ending is nondescript. There are three different endings in the archive, and so when I decided which of the ones that we were going to record. You know, I did my best with all the scratching out and reordering and arrows that Florence Price put in all her stores. I arrived on this is the version that we're going to do. And that version for the students and the one that I was working on was me in red pen and scratches everywhere. And so now at the request of a number of people who want to do it and have heard our recording, I'm engraving the end of the communion service in F as we recorded it, which is not to say that is the definitive version, because again, Florence Price left three different endings for that piece, but I'm engraving my edition of that ending so that other people can piece that together. Cause not everybody can just bop over to the archive and look at her scores.
Well, awesome, Stephen, you have made it to the end of the lightning round. So if our audience would like to get in touch with you or follow you on social media, how can they do that?
Well, my email is the easiest way, stephenc@uark.edu. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N-C @uark.edu. I am on what is now X professionally at @DrC_UARC. And I have a professional account on Instagram, but I don't really use it. And my Facebook account is just for me screaming at my uncles. So I tend to not associate with students or anybody else except personal stuff on Facebook. But email and X and Instagram DMs underscore Stephen Caldwell on Instagram as well. But the big thing is find me on YouTube, University of Arkansas Choir's YouTube channel. All of our work is there. All of the Price scores are there. You can find the Price album is there, and the Price album is streaming on Spotify too.
Well, it was great talking with you today, Stephen. We thank you. Our audience thanks you. And we're happy to call you a part of the choir fam.
It's been absolutely my pleasure to be here. Thanks.
I'm Dean Leithy.
I'm Matthew Myers.
And you've been listening to the Choir Fam Podcast.
Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you liked the show, please rate and review. If you didn't like the show, please let us know how we can better serve our Choir Fam.
You can follow our Instagram page at choirfampod or email us at choirfampodcast@gmail.com. If you have ideas for guests we could invite, or if you'd like to engage us to work with your choir, just send us a message.
We welcome all our listeners.
Yes, you!
To be part of our minisodes. Just look for our episode, Minisode Intro Part 3, from February 16th, 2024, and send us an email with your answers to our Season 3 Lightning Round questions.
We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks again for being a part of the Choir Fam.